Hi, I'm Voice.
I'm Ocean.
I'm Roland.
I'm Inara.
And welcome to Fangs.
How to reject bangs and farts.
No, no synchronicity at
Welcome.
all.
I was supposed to synchronize?
Saturday, people.
Well, too bad. I was rejected.
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 Rejected by all those men in those showers that you dreamed about.
The massive dong fest that is your brain right now.
Hey, I gotta write a bunch of gay porn soon. And lesbian porn. And straight porn.
And you have to do a podcast.
Because you keep deviating.
Rejection.
Reject you.
Today's episode is going to be rejection, criticism, and improving. Tonight, your hosts are myself, Yanara.
Voice.
Ocean.
Roland.
And I'm using that bit before anyway, so. We now have a double intro.
So, it happens to in every writer's career, from greats like Stephen King to small potatoes like us.
Delicious potatoes.
I want to be a purple potato.
At some point, in any writer who wants to become a professional, they get the inevitable rejection letter.
I haven't been rejected. I don't know what to say.
Dead silence.
I don't suck yet. Yet. Notice I said yet. I'm still expecting.
Well, it's one of those things that you come across a lot when you read writers' blogs, and you end up seeing a lot of intro to writing stuff, is just how people deal with rejection letters. It can be as simple as people going, oh, it happens, and moving on to people who lose all interest in writing because they can't handle their first rejection letter.
Well, you've invested so much time and effort into this creation that just to have someone go, no, it's not good enough, can really be quite a psychological thing to endure.
Well, one of my personal experience with it is when I started writing, or deciding to write professionally, my first two stories that I produced both got accepted. And I was like, okay, well, I've heard that usually your first few stories get rejected, so I must be doing pretty good. And I was like, well, when that first rejection letter hits, I'll be fine, because I've already got stuff under my belt. Sure enough, next story, rejection letter. I was like, yeah, this isn't going to affect me. 3 months of not writing later, I realized maybe it did. And then that's when I sat down and did what every other piece of advice is in regards to a rejection letter. You push through it and you take what it gives you, especially if they give you something, and work with it and learn from it and continue on.
See, and I've personally found that rejection letters meant a lot more to me before I was actually published. The first few stories that I sent out were rejected, predictably enough. And then I had a few more stories accepted. I've, you know, had some accepted since. And the rejection letters just don't quite mean as much. They'll be used towards something else in the future.
Which is very true, because now when I get rejection letters, I just kind of look at them and go, well, Too bad.
Your first rejection letter will likely always have the largest impact, but afterwards.
Well, it's the same with your first acceptance letter.
It's a lot like criticism in general. If you spend, you know, the most of your time fretting over it and worrying about what happened, then it's not gonna help you at all. You know, rejection is part of being a writer.
Part of the process. Everyone gets rejected. Even Kyle Gold still gets rejected, I've been told.
It just happens, and so you don't need to worry about it.
Well, that was simple.
Done and done.
If you're rejected, just keep going.
Agonizing over it isn't going to help your case any. If you sit there and agonize over it and worry about what you should have changed, what you could have changed, and actually don't do anything with that, oh, I should have, could have, woulda, you're just kicking yourself in the leg.
You're just back into that editing cycle where you just sit and going around.
Not doing anything for yourself. If you get your rejection letter and you kind of sit there and go, well, shit, I should have done this, or I could have done this, and, oh, I could have done this. You know what? Apply that to your next story. Should have done more editing? Well, guess what? You have another chance. Should have done, you know, another round of, you know, spell check, or, you know, even one of that new program you guys found that checks your...
Edit Minion.
Yeah, the Edit Minion. You know, I should have done another round of the Edit Minion. Well, here's your another chance. Don't look at it as a rejection. Just look at it as a case of, oh, this is my manuscript for how to do it better next time.
In a lot of the cases where, if you go and look at famous writers' writing rooms, or you read biographies about writers, they always end up talking about their rejection letters. In Stephen King's book on writing, he talks about when he started sending his stories away and he got rejection letters, he attached a spike to the wall and he would just impale the rejection letters on the spike. And it got to the point where it tore a hole in his wall because the spike fell down. So he put a bigger spike on the wall and kept doing it. I hold on to all my acceptance and rejection letters. I've got them in my red binder where my submissions go. And it's... The fact is, if your story gets a rejection letter, it doesn't mean it's toast and it's done. There's always going to be another opportunity for you to fix up that story and send it out.
Well, how many stories have you had rejected that you've just found new homes for example?
Exactly.
Yeah, there are different types of rejection letters. Sometimes you just get the, we're sorry, this isn't what we're looking for, which is usually the one most people will get.
It's a pretty politically correct rejection at that point.
It's like going to a job interview and just hearing, you know...
platitudes of... You're great. Thank you.
You're not what we're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, if you're really lucky, you can get the one that says, we really liked your story, but found this or this out of touch, and thus it was rejected. Or if you get the best rejection letter, if that's possible, is the one where it's like, we loved your story, it just isn't what we're looking for because of it doesn't fit the anthology or something.
Which, well, it's not just it doesn't fit the anthology, but it's the one of the best you can get, but also in a way the worst. It's when...
Because you're so close.
It doesn't... It's a great story. I love it, but it doesn't work with the other stories that I've already accepted for the anthology. And it's at that point you kind of sit there and go, well, I wrote a really good story. Why can't you put it in the anthology?
Well, but, in your case, it's pretty easy.
But in some... But the thing is having put together my own anthology and Roland the same thing, there's going to be those stories that are just awesome, but you look at it in the span of all the stories in the anthology, and as much as you love that story, as much as you want it in there, you can't put it in there. And some editors will take that risk and put in a story that's completely opposite to everything else just to break it up. Some will just be like, I'm sorry, I can't.
And sometimes you'll get that story that just breaks everything up and has a warning in front of it because it's at the end of the book.
Yeah, that was the first one I mentioned.
Your boner kill story?
A warning? What warning?
Boner kill story. Fang 5.
I don't know if he did or not.
He said he was going to.
If he does.
But it's so against everything else that's in that anthology. And he's just like, it's going to be the last story because I don't want it to disrupt the rest of the anthology.
See, there's an editor who took a chance.
Yeah. And it may work or it may get criticized. It's all up to the editor.
It's up to the readers, really.
No, it's up to the editor for deciding if that's going to go in there or not. Because if I've read anthologies where they have that one or two disruptive stories, and it can kill an anthology for me.
But well, it's a natural part.
Isn't that why I said it was up to the writer?
You said reader.
Yeah. Isn't that why I said it's up to the reader if it makes or breaks an anthology?
I guess, yeah.
He did. Did you actually put a boner warning in Fang 5? Yeah. Well, kinda. I'm waiting for him to go on.
But you're messaging him.
But yeah, actually, I think the worst rejection letter I ever got was, sorry, we lost your story. You can feel free to submit it to the second anthology. And it was like, yeah, no. I turned around and submitted it to another steampunk horror anthology, and they accepted it, so...
They read it in time.
Yeah, they read it. They actually got it.
Didn't lose their shit.
It's a natural part of the writing process and improving, and, you know, your goals as a professional writer, but really? It's just something we all have to deal with.
Well, in the end, we're all human, right? I mean, losing the story, the shit happens.
The natural progression that generally seems to happen with rejection letters is you do get that, sorry, we're rejecting your story, or your story was not accepted into such and such anthology. Don't let that discourage you. yeah, they didn't tell you why, and really the worst part is going to be sitting there and antagonizing over
what you did wrong.
What you did wrong without knowing what you did wrong. But then the more you write and the more you submit, the more your rejection letters are going to turn into, you know, I'm sorry your story is not in this anthology, but you really did this well. I really liked how you portrayed this, but at the same point, I think this and this and this needed work. And then you just keep taking that and learning from it.
That's like I said.
Yeah.
Do you know anyone who's been rejected and then goes and gets the anthology and reads it and goes, well, why isn't my story in here? It's much better than these.
I think there's always that with person. A story. I think there's always going to be someone, and myself included, like that. I have no qualms admitting that that's one of the reasons I didn't read a lot of the anthologies I was in, is because I didn't want to, or that I got rejected from, is because I didn't want to sit there and compare
your story to every single
one. I'll take a good one. Innsmouth Press did a fungus anthology. My story got rejected for that. I still picked up the anthology. I have yet to read it. I'm actually kind of nervous to read it because I don't want to sit there and open it and go through it and be like, well, why wasn't my story accepted to this? This is all... But there's obviously a reason, and I may not see it.
Coming back to reasons why your story wasn't rejected, or, you know, how you don't know why you weren't accepted into an anthology, don't forget that you're allowed to ask your editors, your readers, why your story wasn't accepted into an anthology. You don't have to be sitting in the dark going, you know, why was this rejected? Was it not good enough? Did it not fit in, etc., etc.? So, you know, just send them an email if it really concerns you why you weren't accepted into a particular story or anthology or whatever.
Just don't feel that you're entitled to a response, because sometimes they may not have anything nice to say, and sometimes they're just too busy to actually lay out why you didn't work.
Or the case I did for a couple of writers in Abandoned Places, I said, I don't have time to get back to you, but this person of my beta reading team stated this about your story. Here, I'll let you talk to Roland about it. And then Roland went and talked to them about it. And
those were interesting conversations.
Well, I know when with one of my rejection letters, they had actually sent me the red letter, stated, you know, what they liked about the story, you know, this point, this point, this point, and then they gave me the reason why it was rejected. And I'll admit I didn't get it. It's like, okay, yeah, no, okay, I'm rejected, sure, but I read their rejection, and I honestly don't know why, it just didn't click what their reason was, but I just kind of left it at, well, it didn't work, it didn't work. And then I picked up the anthology and, you know, curious, okay, what are they looking? Oh, I get it. Okay, so picking up the anthology sometimes helps. Why did I get rejected? That's why I got rejected. I get it now. Go back and read the letter. That makes sense.
That would make sense.
So it doesn't really hurt to pick up the anthology. I mean, you know, curiosity killed the cat. Hi. But,
you know, assuming you were interested in the anthology to begin with, if you're submitting to it, I'm hoping.
I actually hadn't really heard of the anthology beforehand. It was for Heat, just to be specific. I actually had never really heard of Heat before. And saw it in Voice's apartment one time. Didn't think about it again. And then the call for submissions came out, and he showed me the book again. It was like, oh, okay. And then I wrote it without actually really going through the book. And then I got their letter, and then I went through the book, and was like, oh, I get it. So, you know, next time it rolls around, I'm better prepared for writing for Heat again, because I fully intend to try and bash out another story for that, you know, time willing.
What did they say?
They really liked my characters. They liked some of the you know, slice of life pieces I put in there. It's just, it was missing an integral...
like the spark, or?
No, they had that. It was just, I was missing conflict. The conflict I'd included wasn't as drastic enough as they'd wanted for their story. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite grasp that until I read the anthology, and then it was a case of like drama, conflict, drama. Oh yeah, okay, yeah. Drama, conflict, fucking. Got it.
And when it comes to explaining to people why their stories were rejected or why they weren't accepted, even if you as the head editor don't have the answer, like Carl said, somebody does have the answer, and I think it's fair for each writer that submits to something like an anthology that they know why they were rejected. There's a certain level of criteria that has at least been addressed as to why you weren't accepted.
So why not write it
out? Hopefully your story wasn't just so horrifically bad that they didn't have to compare it to any particular standard. But, you know, for the most part, they should have a reason why you weren't accepted. So asking them shouldn't be that much of an issue. I'm always a little bit surprised when people are, quote-unquote, too busy to answer an email. Even if it's just, like, addressing me to address somebody else as mm-hmm. to why their story wasn't accepted, because I have my notes, I have my reasons, and they were considered as part of the selection process. So it's a valid response as to why they were rejected.
What if it's a polite cop-out and your story really was just that bad?
You just say that the story wasn't up to snuff.
Maybe give them a tip or two, like, you should work on this.
You know, this sort of goes back to how we were talking about how to give constructive criticism, and that you address the things that were good with the story, but the things that needed improvement.
Compliment sandwich! Sorry.
Yeah.
Submarine! We made it a sub sandwich.
The submarine now?
What? In that episode, we made it a compliment
submarine. I don't remember. Remind me.
I'm not sure I remember this compliment submarine.
I remember the compliment sandwich now. I remember
the compliment. We did the compliment sandwich, and then it evolved as we were talking about it into, like, a sub, and it was just a really weird conversation.
I have to find this now.
But, you know, like, if your story was truly that bad and you didn't finish reading it, which
I read every story for Punk'd.
No, ironically enough, I read every single story for Abandoned Places, whilst you've read every single story for Punk'd.
So does that mean your turn for the next book?
And so now I'll make the anthology, or you read my
stories? Yes.
I'll read the first paragraph and go, nope. You'll be like, I read the whole thing. You were right.
Roland is right, especially in the furry fandom, where usually the editors are only getting between 15 to 30 stories, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
It is really easy for them to turn around and go, this is the case. However, one of the stories I got rejection for, they're like, we got a really good turnout for this. So unfortunately, due to the 200 plus stories we got for this anthology, we're going to have to turn yours down. It's like, okay, you're not going to get back to me
In a situation like that, the answer is probably just going to be like, your story was really good. We received better.
Huge selection. Yeah, and with that many, that's literally how you take it. There's got to be something better than mine.
But, like, what do you think the maximum number of furry submission and anthology has ever gotten?
Well, I heard mine at, like, I think it was like 35 or something. 34. That was really high. Yeah.
And Punk'd also received,
I think we had 24. Like
20 something.
Because I was talking to a couple editors and they were like, that's a lot. And I'm like,
so I mean, it was still a decent turnout. A
good chunk of work.
And fuck, reading all of those stories takes an absurd amount of effort.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because you're not just reading it. There's a reason why.
I get why some people are so stringent about their requirements. Like, it's,
well, and that's the thing, is that
when every story takes about 3 days to read,
when you have to download another app to read one or two specific stories,
I have about 3 different word processing applications on my phone, only because one deals with TXT, one deals with RTF, the other deals with PDF, and the other deals with .doc, and then one of them deals with .odt.
Good lord.
Yeah, it's retarded.
Reminds me, I need a new laptop.
So.
But yeah, like, when you're actually getting, if you actually get criticism back, how...
View it as a good thing.
Yeah, view it as a good thing. And, you know, we've all been there, I'm sure, where we've gotten feedback where we're just like, grumble, grumble, grumble.
And on that note, don't go online and bash the editor and bash the publication, because that will come back to you so hard.
Which leads us to the segue Ocean was driving on.
Don't be a douche.
No.
I like that segue.
How to deal with rejection letters, and also by the same point, how to deal with things like negative reviews, criticisms during writing groups involving your story. Basically, anytime someone says, I just read your story and blah.
So,
and negative thing about it.
So how do we each deal with constructive criticism? Well, criticism, both constructive and not.
Am I getting the criticism while other people are around me?
Yeah, people may very well be looking at you. I'm thinking more in terms of between like an editor or a beta reader and your story.
You're alone.
If I'm alone, I'm probably like flailing my arms going, what the frick is your problem? And grumble. And then I'll go back and then I'll come back and be like, okay. Or I'll be like, well, actually, maybe you're right. Or I will
is
go.
Is it a lot like being locked in a windowless prison?
It's on my window.
Or a little bit like being a douche and still getting the girl.
Fuck.
I'm drawing parallels to things Ocean.
I think I have three reactions. One is either I will go, oh, that's actually a good point. I didn't think about that. Or, you know, I was like, oh, I was actually thinking about that. Thank you for reminding me. Two is, I see your point and I disagree. I'll keep it the way it is. Or three, or I'm like, did you read this? Like, did you read this? Are you retarded?
I think my first go-to for a rejection is I get sad. Inevitably, it's like the, oh, damn. Because I was, you know, you write something you hope to get in. You know, and so like I said, you inevitably, you get a little sad. It's just, oh, okay, that, I has a sad note.
If someone's going like, I really didn't think this, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for the, you know, the criticism.
For the first version of, the first and only version of New Tales of the Old Ones, one of the guys who reviewed it, when he went to my story, said, not a bad story, but the lottery did it better. And that was his thing. And I sat there and I looked at it and I said, this has nothing to fucking do with the lottery.
He got mad at that for a couple days.
Like, where are you coming from? Like,
who do you think you are?
Well, no, because it's like, here's...
Do you know who I am?
Because the lottery has a very select theme. This story...
You're like, I didn't rewrite the Hunger Games for nothing.
Yeah. Tales of the if this is what I'm thinking of, the lottery and anything I've written read of yours has nothing to do with
it. It's because the thing is the lottery, we've all read the lottery. We all know what it's about.
I haven't read it. I just know what it's about.
Okay.
Girl gets stoned to death.
Yeah. Lottery happens.
Have you seen that South Park episode where they shoot Britney Spears, is it? No?
Oh, okay. Anyway.
That's also
okay. It's a little like the black dot, and it's a thing that happens every year to remove one person from the gene pool.
Right. But it also, it's the enhanced, it's like the Wicker Man. It's like a fertility ritual.
Oh, I've seen
whatnot.
That movie.
Yeah. So anyway.
Every year there's a lottery, and so the story, every family has to go and pull a ball. And whoever gets the black spot, then they focus on that family. And one of those members of the family is going to get sacrificed. They do the same thing in the black spot, whatever, they kill them.
So
they will get good crops.
The Lovecraft story that I did was an outcast within this town gets set up by his quote-unquote best friend, and the girl that this guy is in love with, who is actually secretly courting his best friend, and basically he gets dragged out. He gets dragged out, and they're going to kill him on this lake, and things turn around and Lovecraftian things happen.
And he wins.
But the only thing is, the only mirror between the two is it's at a specific moon phase where this happens. And it's the whole sacrifice thing is the only mirror between the two. But I'm just like, the lottery is horrific for the sheer brutality of this is what's happening. This happens. Everyone's okay with it. Whereas
it's
in
just
the,
a way of life.
Where the general theme for the Killing Field was this person has his only two friends.
Set him up
and betray him in the worst way possible.
The only real comparison between the two is the fact that somebody has chosen to die.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And even then, so, in the lottery, it sounds random. But it is. Was,
it
you
is
know,
random.
So yeah, no, so no I read it.
Magic
and I was,
roll at the rim was the lottery.
So when it comes to people picked. That are just wrong.
Yeah, but so, like, and I read it, and I was just like, oh, that's not it at all. And yeah, there was a couple days where I was like, this makes no sense. And then I reread my story, and I'm like, this still doesn't make any sense. Well, if that's what he comes from it, okay then. And then off I went. And then all the shit happened with the anthology, and now it's being edited for another 8 years.
So, like, from time to time, I find myself somewhat agreeing a little blindly with some of the suggestions that some people make. Like, I'll look at something, and let's take, like, my Taboo story, for example, with the ending. So, I think it was only that Tarl and Yanara had read it at that particular point and had made a comment towards the ending, which I changed. And then later on, I'm like, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I should have kept it as is. But, and then on the flip side, with the same story, I got rather combative with the editing changes to the editor, which...
Understatement.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can really go one of two ways, or... Sometimes I can also just really constructively sort of combat.
So much the same thing happened with the Cthulhu Punk story, where I came in one day and you guys had been talking about it, and suddenly you turn around and it's like, this and this and this and this and this, and then I'm just like, what the fuck?
But by that same kind of token, it's like I looked at the edits going, well, no, these don't really make sense. And so as I'm going down and down and down and through these, I'm like, these are making, you know, I really don't personally agree with these, and so I'm building a third person
come in and you validate, like, am I being over?
Yeah, well, like, I'm building my case for this, and I'm just, yeah, and
that's one of the, what, sorry, I'm
sorry. I had to make sure, I'm like, I'm not being too aggressive with these, am I?
But that's one of the cases, is... Usually, sometimes it is required to go to a third party and go. And I've done it, and I've seen people do it and go, okay, this has me really frustrated. Give me your take on it and let them read it. And sometimes that helps. Sometimes you may interpret something that is a certain way, and people, you know, and someone else with a fresh pair of eyes will be able to sit there and go, well, no, they're not saying that at all. They're actually saying this. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, okay.
And I also read your story.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things with any kind of criticism, and it's been stated a couple times, is you've put a lot of yourself into your story. You've put a lot of time, especially at how many edits you've done, a lot of work. This is something that's from your heart. You put it down, and then someone comes around and goes, yeah, I don't like this, whatever. And it's really hard to sit there and kind of go, not take it personally, because it is your piece. It's your baby.
Well, sometimes it's a pretty hard pill to swallow if you're writing something based off of personal experience, you know, something that has actually happened to you. Then somebody comes up and goes, this situation's unrealistic.
Oh, I've heard many of those stories.
Yeah. And
this isn't how it works.
I can name off, you know, two off the top of my head examples where this kind of thing has happened. And, you know, it's hard not to take something like that personally. You essentially have somebody coming up to you and saying, your life isn't believable.
Well, I could actually believe that about my own life.
You know, there is a large breath of truth to say, you know, life is stranger than fiction. You know, you get all, you know, life, things that happen in real life are in a lot of cases a lot stranger than fiction, because fiction has to be believable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That I'll agree with that.
And so, yeah, it can be hard not to take something like that personally.
Well, it's also, I don't know, sometimes I find it's a lot easier to edit other people's work than my own. So be like, yes, this,
you've
this,
got a lot
this,
invest,
this.
like personally invested in how things flow in your own story.
Yeah, well, I wrote it this way for a reason, yeah, right?
And then, it makes sense up here, but it may not make sense to someone else. That's exactly why it's harder for you. It's why you're supposed to read, you know.
Like, well, that's why I wrote it like
read
that.
It, read it backwards, right? That's what that whole trick is for.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to keep an open mind.
And as was stated at the beginning of this segment, don't go and have your first reaction be to go after the person who gave the review criticism or whatever, or turn around and go shouting it about on the internet that so-and-so said this and I can't believe this and they're an idiot, blah, 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 blah. One of the pieces that we've already mentioned it a couple times in the podcast, and you go to certain things and you hear, especially in the furry fandom, if you end up turning around and bitching, like if you got a rejection letter from Fur Planet and you start bitching about Fur Planet, you know, they all talk. All of the publishing companies in the furry fandom talk. They're all friends.
Hell, they stated as much at Shit Writers Say at RF. We're all sitting in the same room, and they all stated how this person was being a spaz, and they went for dinner the next night with the next publishing company.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, and they, you know, and it will mark you, and it your one rant about one publisher will probably get you marked against all of them.
Sorry, did you guys see the tweet from Fuzz/Fur Planet today? Because he's like, rule number zero for submitting to a publisher, make sure you put their name correctly. He's got the first line of an email. It's like, dear Sofa Wolf.
Whoopsie!
Sorry.
I think I forgot what I was going to say. Something, something, something. If your work is published, and, you know, people are submitting reviews and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
It is important to receive those well. Under any circumstance, even if you don't agree with them, especially if you don't agree with them, it's better to not acknowledge them. Just because more often than not, if you feel it necessary to disagree with someone publicly, you're probably going to put your foot in your mouth and make the situation worse.
Which brings me to my favorite example of this. Which is the case of The Greek Seaman by Jacqueline Howitt.
You just keep dragging her name through the mud, don't you?
Yep. Basically, it's from the website booksandpals.blogspot.ca. The /2011/03/Greek-Seaman-Jacqueline-Howitt. With two T's. Basically, the story goes is she gave it to this guy who reviews many stories, gave him the latest version of her story to read. He reviewed it, gave it, you know, this is a good story, there are so many good things about it, and this is, you know, these are things good with it. However, this, and this were wrong. And there's formatting issues and this. To which she responds by basically shitting all over the website. If you get a chance to go look at it, it's well worth the read of just to see how not to respond to someone's constructive criticism to your book or your story. She just, because... she goes and she fights, and then it basically degrades as they're conversing. She starts name calling, she starts calling his fans names, and it just gets to the point where she's holding on to the 2 or 3 5-star reviews that she has on Amazon and talking about how everyone else is idiots. And what ended up happening was the people who saw her reaction went to Amazon and started doing 1-star, well-written reviews of this book. To the point where it forced them to take it down. Here it is years later, and she's got an editor for the novel, and she's getting it reworked for republication. The thing is, though, is that when someone Googles her name, when the story gets released, or the title of this book, the first thing that's going to happen is this entire shitstorm is going to come up, and it's going to forever be a black mark against her as a writer.
What makes it even worse is she asked him to do the review.
Yeah, she gave him a free copy.
Yeah. So
that's even doubly nasty on her bad.
But that's the thing is, I sent Ocean this anthology or this novel by two authors that I read, and it had primarily had 4- and 5-star reviews, and it had one 1-star review. My star review ended up being a 2 or 3. And this guy responded and he's like, this book was a piece of shit. And one of the writers said, thank you for your opinion. And
that was hilarious.
The guy, the reviewer's response was, what? And the guy's like,
What? I just said your book was crappy and because of this, and it really sucked here. And I didn't even finish reading it. It was so bad.
And the author was just like, all reviews are good. However, he did then open up a discussion on the book that said, if you're going to give a negative review, at least explain why you gave a negative review. Because a 1-star review...
And a name call?
Well, is nothing compared to a 1-star review. Like in my case, the 2-star review where I gave him something like 12 paragraphs of explanation as to inconsistencies and problems I had with the book. And... But that's just what I came across, like the gut shot that hits the lung.
Well, I'll admit, if I'm looking through any review site for books, I will look for something with... Like, I'll just basically ignore things that are just starred, if there's nothing written in there. And I'll look for the things that have someone that have actually put the time in to put a couple comments in the review section.
Yeah, there tends to be a problem when people start reviewing books with only... you know, a star rating. Actually, it reminds you a lot of the XKCD comic. You know, 4 stars, great features, you know, choose from 7 different cities, blah, 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 blah.
7 stars, looks great.
1 star did not warn of tornado. And it's got an average rating of like 3.5 stars. Like, yeah, it's that whole thing where the star rating is fundamentally flawed, and even more so if you're going to rate a book, and then not leave a review about it.
Well, take Goodreads system. 5-star system. 1 star. Didn't like it. 2 stars. It was okay. 3 stars. I liked it. 4 stars. Great. 5 stars. Loved it. So, for example, Trick or Treat got a 2-star review. It's not a bad review. They liked, like, it was okay. They didn't hate it enough to give it a 1-star review. They also explained greatly through it. They gave a
very, very good explanation of, like, I like this, but these stories didn't do this for me. And...
Exactly. And that's another thing with the star rating is, with especially on places like Goodreads, anything that's not a 1-star review is still a good star rating.
But at the same time, everything with a 5-star doesn't mean it's amazing.
Just means you've paid your friends off to rate you.
Or you have some very loyal fans. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, there was a discussion on Dead Robots about rabid fans and things like that.
Well, even they were saying, like, the guys on there were like, you know, I don't even read 5-star reviews. I look at something between 2 to 4 because those are the people that have something to say.
Yeah. Well, you have to, like, if you do a 3-star review and right in the middle, you have to explain why it's a 3-star review. Why did you mark it dead friggin' center average? But anyway, we digress.
And yet I digress.
But with getting, like, say...
Like, if you have people actually giving time to make a review, that's awesome to begin with.
Exactly. Like, even if it's a negative review and they took the time to do it, that's still awesome. They took time out of their day to actually comment on your story. They actually read your story or your novel or whatever anthology, and you know, they had something to say. It may not all be positive. Hopefully they did say something positive, but that's how it goes. Nothing's perfect, especially in the writing world. And I mean, if it really pisses you off that much, as we said, we've all been pissed off by rejection letters or things that we've read.
Or that editor that we just suddenly couldn't stand for some reason.
You just take a step back or talk to a third party and come back to it. I mean, we're all here on some level to be professionals. We all decide to make that step from hobby writer. I don't know about our listeners out there, but us 4 have decided to take it beyond hobby writing. And in doing so, there's a certain amount of responsibility to the craft, to our work and to other people's works. And it's a matter of taking it in a professional attitude, which also means taking it as an adult and not instantly knee-jerking everything. If you see something you don't agree with or it makes you angry, going in with a knee-jerk reaction means you're going to write something that's going to be stupid, unthought of, and you might go back to it and go, oh, whoopsies. Shit,
count I shouldn't have said that. Just count to 10. Take a breath.
Like, it's interesting that, like, we've gone through three stages of writing, right? After you've written it, you're getting your edits and beta reads back, and you're already dealing with critique right there. And then afterwards, you're hoping the publisher or the editor is going to accept it. And if not, you're taking critique right there. And even if you do get it published, you're still going to get reviews that are going to be critiquing and possibly looking down your work. So there's no one point, once you have given your work to anyone or put it out there, where or it's not going to have a chance to have someone critique or say a negative thing about it. So if it's something you want to handle and learn how to handle right away.
Yeah.
Because there's at no point, unless you're going to write for your own personal fantasies and never show them to anyone. And I mean never show them to anyone.
Ever.
Because as soon as you do, someone can immediately go, well, but.
Yeah.
So if it's an important part of who we are as writers, learning to accept this and handle it and take it.
In a nutshell, yeah.
Do we want to talk about reviewing or talk about improving?
I don't know. I think we kind of lumped that in with everything.
Well, it all comes down to if you get rejected, as a writer, the only thing you can really do with it is to take what's good in like what they've stated. Because if someone keeps sitting there and telling you, as in my case, you're using a lot of blank as blank in certain action scenes, you use that a lot. It's not bad, but
it could be better.
It could be better. And I had Spark, when he was beta reading one of my stories, comment on that, and I was like, F, right, Ocean and Roland have mentioned this before. Crap. And then I go through. But everything that I do now when I read one of my pieces and I'm going through that first and second edits are things that people have brought up during constructive criticism, reviews, back getting feedback from editors. It's all stuff that people have mentioned that I sat there and kind of looked at my own work and gone, you know what? They're right about this. Maybe there is a better way, and there usually is. And then from there, I kind of expand as a writer, and it helps my craft as it goes along.
Yeah, I still remember when you started pointing out LY adverbs in my story, and I'm like, yeah, I could just cut most of these out. It's not doing anything. It makes things shorter, concise, quicker to read.
When it comes to taking reviews, I mean, just don't take them personally and realize that there is a seed of truth to most, if not all of them. Even if some guy's coming up to your story and saying this is a pile of shit, your opinion has been noted, is valid. I may disregard it at my leisure.
Thank you for your opinion.
That's why, you know, I like to get more than one beta reader, because say I have five and, you know, one person says, this doesn't work, this is horrible, and the other four go, oh, that was pretty good. Probably going to side with the four over the one.
Or at least even see what the other one was nitpicky about.
Yeah.
Or
at your own discretion.
Yeah, maybe you're going to take the opinion from that one person, tweak it to sort of have the same theme, but also take into account this other guy's thing, and then everybody goes, well, it's awesome.
Oh, yeah, or I can take that one piece and ask the other four about it, and they can be like, actually, yes or no,
that's a good point, too. Yeah. They may have not noticed it. They may have just fallen into reader mode instead of editor mode, and bringing that up, they could go back and be, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I just kind of glossed over that, but really, it actually doesn't make sense.
Well, I had a subtle betrayal in one of my stories that I wrote.
Female betrayal?
No. And
it was subtle.
And the two beta readers I had for it both came back to like, and I was like, oh, this is brilliant. I'm effing brilliant. And then they came, I read the first beta reader that came back to me, and I'm like, oh, they didn't get it at all. They completely did the opposite of what I was thinking. Oh, maybe they just didn't get it. Then I get the second beta reader, same thing. Like exactly the same comments, and I'm like, okay, I need to fix this, and I need to make it not subtle.
Well, it was the samurai story I just finished writing, where it's like, every beta reader, I'd read it, and I'd wait for them at the end to be like, so, how did he know who to kill? And they're all like, was it this? I'm like, no. Okay, back to the writing board. Next person, how did he do it? Until I finally, like, the last two or three are like, oh, it was this. I'm like, yes, good, okay.
For those that have been paying close attention to this podcast, you can hear when we talk about certain rejections we've all faced, how it can affect us, because I'm sure the emotion to some of them has come across while we've been speaking. You may never truly get over rejection, and the fact is I think if you ever did, your writing would lose something because it meant you didn't care.
Well, it's very similar to a job interview, you know.
I was about to say that, honestly, writing rejection letters, I could care less.
Yeah, I had
there
no real
issues. There will always
be issues.
More anthologies.
Writing?
Job rejections.
Yeah.
I take a good deal more seriously.
Well, I would think so, because the job is you and the writing is just your work.
Yeah, like... Yeah, I think it all boils down to how much of an effect, how much of an impact this all has on my life. And I do the writing for fun. Mm. Getting published is icing on the cake. Mm. As much as I enjoy being accepted, I can deal with being rejected.
Because it's part of the parcel.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is part of writing. Being rejected is fundamentally a part of being an author. And so... Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. You will be rejected, and so will everyone else around you.
And it will affect you. It will maybe make you pause in your writing. The fact is if one rejection letter makes you stop writing completely, maybe you shouldn't be a writer.
Rejection letters are the springboard of the writing world. You're going to bounce off of it and land properly the next time, or you're just going to land on your ass and you're going to have to do it again.
I look at this very much in the same way that I do for accepting criticism or, like, dealing with yourself critically. That if you let this affect you that much, it doesn't help anyone. It especially doesn't help you. It doesn't help, you know, if you're still sending this off to other people and you're not...
Changing it?
You know, you're not taking the criticism seriously, and you're just submitting the same old tripe, then, you know, it wastes everybody's time.
You deserve that rejection letter! Sorry.
Yeah, if you don't improve your craft, then, yeah, you kind of do deserve those rejection letters.
So, what other ways can you improve other than, you know, getting negative critique and just... getting rejected over
people. Attention. People better at writing than you.
Yes, I'm on my way to the top.
Pay attention to...
He said sleep with people that are better at writing than you. Working on it.
Yeah, we already did that podcast.
Pay attention to the things that people say about your writing, and especially if they're true. I gave a review to this one lady's thing, and I said, this doesn't feel like it's being edited at all. Her response was, like, she PM'd me and she said, well, the reason it felt like that was because it didn't actually see an editor. I just published it. Well, and if you're upset about my criticism that it didn't see an editor and it didn't see an editor, maybe it should see an editor.
So another good program would be the Edit Minion. I think that sounds like a fantastic tool for improving your work. Once someone's come back to you and given you your rejection and stated, you know, needs work. Well, that's one more tool to employ.
For those that don't know, Edit Minion is a program that you cut and paste your short story. Apparently can also handle novel size. But you post it into the box and get it to process it. And it will pick up things like weak words and adjectives and
cliches, passive voice.
Yeah, and it will also rate you on a color scale.
It'll give you a word count of like your top 10 most used words, which is always nice.
Yeah. So though apparently if it's your person's name, then yeah.
Obviously disregard it.
Or use some more pronouns.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, I'm sorry. I get really annoyed when like... Candace walks over and Candace says this, and then Candace bent over and then she talked to Candace, and you're just like,
but I don't think it picks up. Well, no, it does pick up names.
Well, you did bring that up with my heat submission, and it was very valid.
Oh, did you? Yeah, well, that I think you also had the dialogue thing that I get annoyed at, where it's like, hi, Yanara, how are you doing? It's good to see you, Yanara.
And this is how you're supposed to take criticism, right here, where you're observing it. Yes.
Golf clap. What?
No, that's exactly how you...
Well, no,
you guys literally just went through it. He brought up the things that he saw wrong in your story, and you're like,
and fix it.
There you go. Anyway.
Ultimately, we've been over how to deal with criticism and how to improve, respectively. That take other people's opinions into account. That is ultimately how you become a better writer. You know, a man is not a... You cannot simply carry the weight of everything on your shoulders alone. Ultimately, you need people to provide an outside perspective of how your writing needs to improve.
They're your baby, so they will always be special. And the only way that I've ever heard of someone's like being able to properly self-edit their thing all alone is when they leave it alone for a year to 2 years, come back to it, and they're like, oh, I forgot I wrote this. And you start reading it, and you're like, oh, crap, look at all this stuff. I totally forgot I wrote all this. Oh, my God, what's going on?
Why, you sound like you've experienced this voice.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just like, go back and read something you wrote 2-3 years ago, and just like, what did I do?
Well, prime example.
I think she has something to say.
New Tales of the Old Ones. I went back after they were like, okay, well, we're going to go through it. And I said, well, can I go over it and send it to you the re-edits? Because I think the edits are wrong. Oh, yeah, sure. And then I noticed that at the last third of the story switched tense completely.
And they never caught it.
Oh. And I was like, oh, well, but it had been 2 years since I had written it. It was the second story I ever got published.
I was just doing my edits for one of the stories that's going to be an anthology. And, like, I wrote that, well, it's almost been a year now. And I was just going through it. And he's like, oh, just make these changes here. And I'm rereading the whole story going, no. I've been complaining about that on the podcast.
Plus, like, I want to redo The Black Spot. I want to do Tiny Hooves. I want to redo Solar Wings. Like, there's so many I want to redo. At this point, by the time Roar gets back to me, I'm going to be like, hey, so that version you have? Yeah, use this one.
That's okay. When I was going through one of my taboo stories, I caught, like, a huge, like, it most people won't catch it, but I will. And it's just in reference to eyes that a certain species don't have.
What?
Yeah.
The point is that you can look back and realize you have improved because you're able to look at your work again and go, oh, clearly I've gotten better.
Well, and that's exactly it, because you should notice that you're getting better, and it's all point in getting criticisms and rejections and all that.
Just keep writing. Just keep writing.
Just keep writing. Just keep
and
writing.
And write with the intent of trying to improve and trying to critique your own work.
Exactly.
Another thing that a lot of people keep asking me lately is, you know, they're looking for beta readers or editors, and they don't know anyone, and so I always send them to the Furry Writers Guild, because although it's a little small these days, the more people that get there, the better help we can build the community, and you know, like, you can still find people who will beta read that for you on there.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to emails. We have a question. Here, why don't you read it?
Thanks. Should I say who it's from?
Sure.
We got an email from Ray Chan. A question about character relatability.
Try that one again.
Question about character relatability. Do you think that readers can care about a character who is rich and conflicts, and the conflicts that rich characters have? I found myself watching a show that was about a high roller... are about high roller lawyers who are constantly fighting with rich clients or other rich lawyers, and I found myself unable to relate to, and quite frankly, unable to care about these characters' problems, because even if they failed miserably, they could just go get a rich job somewhere else or live in the millions of dollars. The same is true for other movies and shows. If the conflict is not physical, i.e. they are in physical danger, I do not care about these people, because whatever they are going through isn't serious enough for me. For me, this is alleviated to a degree by shows written by Sorkin, but most of these characters are not rich and powerful. A friend pointed out that the only thing we middle/lower-class readers could probably relate to is if a rich character had a lower-class problem like alcoholism. Also, Roland said, there's a reason why you don't do everything. Thing is, sometimes people do things for
there's a reason. There's a reason why you do everything.
Why don't we just stop at that one question?
Okay.
Yeah, let's address this one first.
Okay.
So, I don't know. It really somewhat depends, I think, on the position that these people are in. Because in a lot of cases, money isn't really the defining factor. It's
the
person's relationship with money. You know, lawyers aren't exactly relatable, and they're often villainized. So, no, I don't think a lawyer is going to be all that relatable. If it was, you know, if it's like this rich billionaire that volunteers in soup kitchens and helps the homeless, then they're probably going to be a lot more relatable than somebody who, you know, is spending their time in casinos with fast women, fast cars, and, you know, a whole lot of coke.
Does the character actually have to be relatable for me to care about them? I'm sure there's plenty of characters that I can't relate to, but I find them interesting.
Oh, yeah, like Honey Boo Boo, Real Housewives of
America. I don't care.
I'm just listening to stories. Like, yeah. How many people can actually relate to
for those type of realities? I think it's the human nature that they relate to, but...
But funny thing as well is that with Honey Boo Boo is that you've got the mom who is specifically saving the proceeds from the show to put towards, you know, the kids' lifestyles after the fact. And so... It's things like that where people are like, yes, I actually, you know, have respect for this.
Well,
and, you know, their situation could fall apart in that people might actually feel a degree of sympathy for them.
Take reality TV shows and why they're so popular. You get people from all walks of life on shows like Survivor and such like that. They can be, like, look at Bachelor and Bachelorette, Millionaire, Matchmaker, things like that. It's not what they do as a job that makes them relatable. It's them as a person and their personal conflicts. Reality TV shows are built around sticking a bunch of people in a room, and the fact that people have drama just in being proximity to each other, and there's always going to be conflict, and there's always going to be one-upmanship, and that's just what people do. And that's what we're all relating to when we watch the show.
Well, and you know, I think that this particular scenario that Ray Chan's given us is rich people fighting about money. You know, like if their situation falls apart, then they can just go buy more money. but then you have, like, and so in that case, then no, these people aren't relatable, and I'm not going to feel sorry for a rich person that loses their money in a battle for more money. But you have Batman, you have Iron Man, who are rich billionaires. And the fact that they are doesn't make them any less of a superhero, because that's their character exists solely to, you know, fight crime. And if they fail, there's a tangible result on the rest of the story that you as the reader or the viewer likely care about. So it really all depends on the context, where it doesn't matter how much money the character has. That's just a compliment to the kind of person they're already portrayed as.
Well, I'm going to use an example here. America's Next Top Model. I'm not a female model. I should not be able to relate to these characters, these people who are actually not characters. One of the women on there cheats on her boyfriend back home with a model from France, calls up her boyfriend the next day, and is just like, she has to now admit that it happened. And then, of course, being reality TV show, they play the conversation between them on the show, and he's devastated. She's trying to fix things. She's still in bloody France. And the thing is I'm not a girl. I'm not a model. I'm watching this having gone through pretty much the exact same thing maybe 2 years earlier. and was just like, I turned it off and I stopped watching the show because I could not handle it because I related too much to that. But that was, it's all about the situation and what the characters are going through on an emotional level and their personal problems, rather than it is, this is who they are. This is their profession. They have money. They don't have money. It doesn't, like, how many of us, Starship Troopers, how many of us are friggin' Marines running around killing giant bugs? None of us. We can still relate to the characters because of their very real problems.
Or Firefly.
Or Firefly.
Now, sort of, you mentioned whatever it was, that show. And then
America's Next Top Model.
Yeah. And then think about something like Biggest Loser,
mm-hmm.
where the entire point of that show is to be relatable to, you know, your average American, you know, the person who's 5'8", weighs 350 to 400 pounds, and they're trying to lose that weight. And so these people look at these characters and see themselves and go, this is a struggle that I can identify with. And, you know, garners very polarized opinions from either side. And, you know, these people could have millions of dollars in their bank account, but that doesn't change the situation they're in. It doesn't change how relatable that situation is to your typical overweight American.
And that's the thing is, like, if you look at, like, I don't know this program, I don't know what show it is, but I bet you if you look past, here are high stakes lawyers doing all these things with money and they have money and whatnot, and you go under it, and there's still some very real personal problems that are happening. I mean, yeah. Look at friggin' that stupid show about the rich wives of rich people. They have money, they do really stupid things,
The Rich Wives of Orange County and the Canadian version of Vancouver or something.
Yeah.
But I personally don't watch those because I don't relate to those characters. I find it annoying. And
well, I think it gives it a headache because it's horrific. Overly dramatic is what gets to me.
I was channel flipping today and ended up on a show called Bethany, and I decided to opt out for this show called Bethany because their real world drama seemed to be a little more ridiculous to me than watching The Amazing World of Gumball.
Which, like, is very relatable.
Especially
with Richard being duped up.
I'm going to guess that this show, the emphasis is being put too much on how much money they have, and that's probably not the point.
Mm-hmm. No, the show in question, it's...
I'm curious what show it is.
Suits. It's about a guy who's never gone to college, has an eidetic memory, and gets a job at one of the highest, biggest firms in the world or whatever, and then struggling with their clients, blah blah blah, politics.
Oh. But, like, you want to talk about stuff like that, you know, if you look at any of the shows that present this prodigy like person who either has a background or doesn't but is amazing at what they do. Take Lie to Me, for example. I think
Sheldon Cooper,
Wall Street Never Sleeps, Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, it's
there are so many situations where these characters exist in different
mm-hmm.
realities that I just, it would be so easy just to look pat, like, if you just removed money from the situation. And a lot of these shows ironically remove money from the situation by making them all rich. It's where money just isn't an issue, and so you can do whatever you want. And I think that's what shows like this tend to do, because if I wanted to go watch really depressing shows about the very realistic battle of poverty, I would watch British television. And they're very good at making situations realistically uncomfortable.
Well, even like Coupling, a funny, hilarious show that had some amazing episodes, I can't watch it long because it's too realistic.
Yeah. Misfits is about this group of juveniles with superpowers, and I'm watching it, I'm like, this is way too real. Like, mm-hmm. it is depressing.
I don't know if the characters have to be relatable. Why can't you just also have a character that, you know, you have no relation to, but you're more interested in knowing what it would be like in that situation, being that character? Or you just want to watch someone fail. The exact opposite.
Yeah. You just want to watch someone fail. Isn't that a bad thing? Yeah, or what's wrong with watching a show and just wanting to watch them fail or wanting to watch them succeed?
I just think there's a little too much focus on why they aren't relatable.
Sometimes it's like, I want to do a show about lawyers.
Very much so. I'm not a lawyer. It doesn't mean I can't enjoy a show like, about lawyers.
Like the family sitcom, they're trying to make those people relatable.
I am not Snake Eyes, but I find Snake Eyes enjoyable.
This person being a lawyer doesn't mean that I can't find them relatable because I'm not a lawyer. They are still a human being. They're white.
They feel emotions. They
have blue eyes.
They're still going to get screwed over somehow.
Yeah, they still have real life issues that you can
understand. And if I can identify with the situation that they're being put into, then by that sense, they're relatable.
But moving on.
Yes, we are.
I think Roland should read the next question. Because it's kind of addressed
in as I've said,
this continues the email.
There's a reason why you do everything. Thing is, sometimes people do things for reason or reasons they don't even know. People can be fairly random or inconsistent. Characters and stories don't have that luxury. Characters have to be simpler than actual real live people because we hold them to the standard that they must make sense. Stories have to make sense. Real life often doesn't. But, you know, if you've never had a girlfriend that...
Or boyfriend.
A girlfriend or boyfriend or...
significant other?
Some sort of...
Relationship.
Relationship where the other person has been batshit crazy certified.
You just don't understand the pain behind watching them make their decisions.
These people don't operate on logic.
They do shit, and you're standing there going, what?
Yeah, and the things they do don't have a logical conclusion. Like, they, you know, there's no process. There's no linear progression to what these people are doing. And so when you're writing a story, people don't always understand this. And you have to...
Explain why.
You have to create... this progression that may not even exist. But when it comes to storytelling, you have to make sense. You know, you can say somebody got struck by lightning and a cow within a, you know, 5-second window, and people might not think that's realistic, even if it still happened. You have to put sense into that scenario and say, this is what happened instead. We don't have the luxury of random consequence.
True.
So, see what happens when you send in emails, people? We respond to them, and it engages in conversation. You know what you should do? Send us an email.
Where can they send that email?
I keep forgetting the
podcast@fangsandfonts.com.
Or tweet us at
Fangs and Fonts.
Or go to our website.
FangsandFonts.com.
Hey!
Or check out our Facebook page, Fangs and Fonts, on Facebook.
Yay!
Let us know any topics you guys want to hear, guests you'd like us to talk to, suggestions, complaints, comments, ramblings, etc.
We really would like to hear what you guys want to hear us talk about. It's fairly important because we just kind of have a discussion about what we're going to talk about usually a week or two before we record the episode. But if there's something that you guys actually do want us to talk about, we'd be more than happy to hear your choice and to go with it. Because this is not just for us, this is for you and the furry writing community. And the reason we're doing this is because we like talking about writing, and if we can inspire you or help you, that is the most important thing to us.
I'm getting some wicked deja vu back to, like, you know, elementary and junior high. I'm doing this for you. I'm not doing it because I enjoy it. I'm doing this for your benefit.
Ouch.
It comes out of the mouth of every frustrated, like, teacher sixth grade ever. Teacher doing some sort of extracurricular activity.
Well, we do it because we care.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in and listening to us again. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Once again, the book we're going to be reviewing is Summer Hill. So go out and read it.
Read along with us. Give us your thoughts on it.
We'll be done at some point.
I plan on reading it on the cruise.
End of April?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yep.
2 months. Hopefully we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good night.
Okay.
It wasn't
too bad. And done.
Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.